Hello, and welcome to recording number 14 of Gary Gygax's Artifact of Evil, an annotated recording. Today is August 9th, 2021. We're returning to page 125. I'm going to start on the last paragraph. Gord, Geller, and the general company has made it to Selene and into audience with Queen Yolanda. Something I didn't mention yesterday, I should have brought up, was that Yolanda mentions that she's part of an alliance that is of good, good nations to oppose, works of the various evils, Scarlet Brotherhood as the evil, who are gathering the tripart artifacts that would reawaken Tharizdun. Now, this isn't something, Scarlet Brotherhood, supposedly that's what they want, but definitely not us or Grazd, Yggdrasil or Zuckmoy, none of them want to see Tharizdun return. So they're playing a very dangerous game, but they're also trying to get ahead of the Scarlet Brotherhood. So now they've met with Queen Yolanda, and she has brought them over to a little side room off of the General Palace where there's a big celebration going on among the elven people. And so here we have them introduced to the Constable of Selene, Parsifal. And I'm going to continue right here on the bottom of page 125, last paragraph. "We had some small intelligence of this entire scheme," said Parsifal, unrolling a vellum map as he spoke. "A week ago, a distant cousin of mine came seeking information, which I did give him. Melf, my adventurous kinself, has sworn fealty to the Lord Morden Kanan. He was here to discover the whereabouts of a band of reavers, reportedly led by a renegade dwarf, a bandit company that I myself am hunting." The constable paused momentarily to peer intently at the rolled map of Selene and its bordering territory. Then he went on. "Here," he said, pointing to the edge of the Sus Forest, "in the southernmost region of Selene. This is where they first struck. A royal patrol spied them, but the villains killed nearly all of its number. These brigands then moved northward. They sacked and burned several small communities and waylaid a cavern too. They were shielded with a powerful Diomer, so that our magic users were unable to locate their whereabouts. Three forces were sent to intercept them, but these murderers somehow slipped between two of them and seemed bent on coming directly for here. Instead, they turned back and went northeast, getting clear and away into the Kron Hills before we knew. Melf is now trying to intercept them, I believe," Parsifal concluded. Break. So here we have Melf, who was Luke Gygax's character, and Morden Kanan, who was Gary Gygax's character. So we have in this that Melf has now sworn fealty to Morden Kanan and is a cousin of Parsifal, the Constable of Selene. So definitely Melf is connected to the royalty of Selene here. And then we get a little bit about... We're hearing about Abmi, of course, and his evil band. We know from this, we're said that there are patrols going through the southern Sus Forest. And in general, Selene is a very protective place, so there would be many patrols, I would say, going around the whole area. Now, Melf is able to slip into the Kron Hills, and through it, I would say that he was destroying some villages and such, but I don't know at this point. I think he had the being more direct after he entered the Kron Hills. And the Kron Hills is home to a large community of gnomes. Size or not, they are an extremely effective force, as shown by what they were able to do up in the Flinty Hills. resisting the encroachment of the humanoids who sack Spine Castle and Johnsport and part of the Bone March up there, and still the gnomes of the Flinty Hills under their king were able to resist all that. So Abmi slips through, and so here we have more of the that the elves were sent three different forces to intercept them. Melf under Lord Mordenkainen is hunting them, as well as the constable Parsifal. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 126, third paragraph. During his short recounting of these events, the constable had traced the path of the brigand gang on the map. Geller studied the chart carefully and then asked, "Where do you suppose they are now?" "Our agents in Hamlet have just informed us that a band of evil-looking men and demi-humans passed through that village 3 days ago. That is the last we have heard. The problem is now one for Valuna or Furiundi. Selene is no longer concerned." The constable said this last with a great deal of satisfaction in his voice. All right, break. So it caught that the Selene has agents in Hamlet. So that, you know, we have the module, the village of Hamlet. And so I wonder who the agents are, if they're an addition to what we know of Hamlet, whether they're ones that pass through, are they on the outskirts of Hamlet, who are they dealing with? So that casual mention, again, is it's one of the things I love about the Gord novels, because here it immediately brings up, we have a known location, and we configure that, wow, now we have agents, several different agents there, mainly because Hamlet is such a close location to the Temple of Elemental Evil. So Selene is keeping an eye on the comings and goings in Hamlet. All right. And then we show that there is this short-sightedness with Parsifal, that he is the constable of Selene, so he's concerned with what's happening in Selene itself. Whereas, you know, someone else, I know Queen Leolanda is concerned with, you know, like a wider, you know, wider look to see what can affect Selene from the outside. And something like the artifact of all evil, that certainly is something that could suck Selene down with it, because it's, you know, this incredible, if Tharizdun was released, or if the artifact itself is extremely powerful, even if it is not joined with one of the other two parts. So whoever gets it, if Uz gets his hands on it, now Selene is rather with far away, but still, if Uz gets his hands on it, I know his plans are for world conquest. So it sounds like any of the elves who are in the know should be concerned about stopping this before it comes back and haunts Selene. All right.
He seems a little bit like the stereotypical elf.
Yes, and so does Dothmar, the prince consort. And I'm glad to see that, in a sense, because I'm glad to see that they're showing that Gygax's elves are far from perfect or all-knowing. And they are, you know, they're on the haughty side. And even though it does show why that, you know, their great kingdoms have disappeared, even though they're such a long-lived race and they were very powerful, they too, you know, they too did not see what was coming. And, you know, they have slipped into the background of what's going on in the Flaness. So they are, you know, like, they're still there, they're still powerful, and they interact more with the, even if Selene is kind of sealed off, you can see by the celebration that was going on that it wasn't sealed just to elves. There were all sorts of things, and they have ambassadors, and So they aren't quite Tolkien style elves. They're a little more down to earth, but they still have characteristics, I think. And I like to have that in my game, that they have characteristics that are alien to, you know, other nations, other human nations within the Flaness. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 126 and the third paragraph from the end. "You err," Gord interjected, allowing his scorn for the effete seeming elf to show in his tone and expression. "If those outlaws bear what we fear, their escape could mean the end of all goodness and reason, and the fall of your isolated little kingdom, too." Parsifal flushed and was ready to retort, but Greenleaf spoke first. "The manner of my comrade is wrong, Lord Constable, but his words bear much weight. Not just kingdoms are at stake here. We fight for the world." "Say on, Druid," Parsifal said expressionlessly. "Your queen sent you to us because Selene is in jeopardy. You must aid us immediately, for if we do not intercept that band of brigands, the consequences might be dire." The constable looked solemnly at the half-elven druid, then shrugged. "Use your power to follow after these outlaws, then, just as you did to enter Onstad. Each use of spell runs the risk of alerting the enemy, or worse," Onselvan said sternly. "It is not to niggle that you were sent here, Lord Constable, but to give assistance as our queen directs." Said Parsifal, becoming uneasy under the piercing eyes of the old mage. "I suppose that you are right, Onselvan. The greater the strength of those seeking to foil the machinations of the lower planes, the better our chances for a happy result." With that, Parsifal indicated the position of Onstad on the old Vellum map. "It is some 40 leagues from here to Hamlet, 3 days of hard riding, for much of the way is through the moundy crons. Mounted on winged steeds, though, steeds such as the royal hippogriffs, the journey is one of but hours. Such aerial travel is perilous, of course, but you all seem capable, and time is precious. Agreed." There was a murmur of general assent from the 8 strangers, and a brief nod of approval from Onselvan, so the constable nodded with finality and spoke again. "Do what you must do, then, between now and mid-morning. I will have instructions sent to the staviary, the place which houses the hippogriffs, and all will be ready at the appointed hour. 8 mounts and an escort of 12 of Her Majesty's guards will await. You will be taken as far as the northernmost edge of the Kron Hills." Then he added with a note of warning, "No farther will our steeds take you. No deeper will our guards go, for Selene will retain her isolation, nor will we deal with the men of other kingdoms. It is enough that we take such as you to the very edge of human realms." Break. A staviary, a stable, an aviary, I guess. So I find that amusing. So I'm breaking right here. And we get a little information, 40 leagues from here to Hamlet, which he considered 3 days of hard riding, and just hours on the hippogriffs. And then we can add the idea that hippogriffs are part of the, you know, the royal guards, and part of the royal stable of Selene. Selene is still bearing its isolationist ways, in a sense, and it's in a good position to, you know, isolate itself, because the Sus Forest is a kind of wall. You know, it really would, yeah, and that is a great word there, staviary. And so they are in a good position to remain isolated. It'd be very difficult for an army to march through the Sus Forest or through the hills to reach Selene. We have a map up here, Chris has put, and we show Hamlet, and we show the gnarly, and we can see at the curve at the bottom of the hills there, we can see Onstad there. With the Kron Hills, you know, it is It is a very populated for, you know, the area, 20,000 gnomes in that area there. On this map, there are a good number of little towns. I think most of them come from the Living Greyhawk campaign. We can see Nulb and the Temple of Elemental Evil and the Moat House all marked down. And probably what we'd see in Verbabank is a lot of very small farming towns without too many anything, I would say, much bigger than a hamlet within the area, with the city of Verbabank being the biggest thing. And it is a general, not a huge city. I believe its population is like 12 to 15,000, at least 12 to 15,000 combat. It was always difficult back then to, from the early designs, whether they were talking, because it was, you would get a note about the total population, but then you would find that, then you would find that the population was being said to be fighting humans. And then you'd add on humanoids, and you'd have to add on non-fighters and children and the old. So by Anna's map here, it's about 4 hexes to Hamlet, but that's just as the crow flies. Yeah, and stated pops were human males who could fight. And I did some work on from the first edition of trying to figure out the stated population figures. And one of the things that you would notice is in the description would mean that you would find humanoids and demi-humans listed, but they were not part of that overall population. And it's stated, I'm not sure, I guess it might probably does say directly that it's human males. I'm a little surprised that was part of the original description there. But because with, you know, AD&D, and the way the modules are written and some of the setting materials, it should certainly be any humans who could fight. So, you know, we really have to. I think at some time it's going to be a really good project to sit down and work out population figures for 576 CY. And then those who want to can work out population figures for some of the later key dates, like introduced in FTA, From the Ashes, or The Adventure Begins, and especially in the Living Greyhawk Gazette tier. I think those would be good time periods to work out set populations that people can use or not, but it would be nice to have a little bit of that information just generally available for DMs to be able to grab up. And if they don't feel like detailing the populations across the whole Flaness, we could have a set bit of work there, which can give a starting point or an idea, which DMs can alter as they like. All right. Again, Arcival seems very, very hidebound in this isolationist business here. And Anselvin, who's the real royal court wizard, he is pushing toward more involvement. Well, Parsifal, as the constable, really wants to say, even though he's going to help a little, really isn't going all out to help the group. It's been put up about the population from the 83 gold box. And it says, population accounts for humans only, the normal citizens who make up the bulk of a nation. Mercenaries, lawless groups, semi-independent, and or independent communities and groups based in border or major geographical regions are excluded. As we look to what, was said back in Saga of Old City about Stoink, the city itself only had, I'd say it was like 15,000 regular citizens, and although there were a lot of mercenaries and such that came through, the area around Stoink was from 50,000 to 70,000. So Now, there's a question Chris asks about where. What about places with no humans, like the Kron Hills? What happened in the folio in 83 set is they would mention the demi-human populations in a separate comment. It would sometimes be, I think, a list in the general stat list about a country or a nation or a city, but then you would get some commentary within the within the couple paragraphs that described it. Again, multiply, there was the idea to multiply by 20% to determine the number of males fit to bear arms, multiply by 10% to get the number of males in prime condition. All figures show only inhabitants and do not include any garrisons. From the folio and then from the gold box, there's information about demi-humans and humanoids. The populations, they are extremely vague, which is, and that is what we got from the folio and gold box set, and it does get the DM to use his or her imagination to develop the setting. But it to me, a lot of this is extremely inaccurate. It's just it's lots of times there's a lot of confusion and contradiction and a lot of things that don't make sense. But the folio and the 83 box set were not being designed to be necessarily accurate. They were being, supposedly the whole thing is being told by Pluffett Smedger from the far future. And the look back on all this is, it's not meant for the DM to take as unvarnished truth. Gygax loved the idea of the unreliable narrator. And even in this, where what we're just talking here, we get the idea that we're seeing things from Parsifal's point of view at one point. So, again, his stories, they're very rarely being seen from an objective or omniscient viewpoint. Like right here, we're getting the one paragraph. It is the thought process of Parsifal that is being expressed here. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 127 and the final paragraph. A fair enough arrangement, said Curly Greenleaf, stroking his palm over his bald pate. The gesture emphasized the human side of the druid's heritage, for elves never grew bald. What of our quarry? Won't they still be beyond our reach? Only 2 days at worst, Parsifal asserted. See where Hamlet lies, he added, pointing to the central portion of the hilly region along the northern border of the elven kingdom. These murderous rogues move erratically and with no great haste. This very night sees them no great distance from Hamlet, I am sure. If they are near Verbabank, as I am sure they are, tomorrow they will ford the Velverdiva River or head for the upper reaches of the gnarly forest. In either case, you will be here. And again Parsifal pointed at the map, indicating the place they would be conveyed to. 2 days' swift pursuit will enable you to catch your foes. How do we follow these malign reavers? Gord demanded. You're leaving us afoot. The court mage replied to this. Never fear, Gord of Greyhawk. I'm doing my part in this too. Friends and good horses will be awaiting you when you arrive. You will have all the help that Selene and the elves of the Whelkwood, too, can provide, although our stout constable still seems somewhat uncertain as to the importance of your quest. I do comprehend its true nature and meaning. Enough, then, Parsifal interjected. This night is most sacred to Selene and all elf kind, and I must return to the revel. A servant will show you to your quarters. Although I suppose, as guests of Queen Yolanda, you're entitled to join in our celebration if you choose. The latter was said in a tone so dark as to discourage ready acceptance of the vague invitation, while the others turned and started to follow the liveried elf, who had silently appeared at Parsifal's mention of quarters. However, Deirdre addressed the constable. "Thank you, Lord Parsifal, for the kind and generous offer of sharing," she said. "I, for one, have no desire to brood in some room for the next few hours, and would indeed enjoy sharing elven joy at Midsummer's Night." "Come then, fair lady cavalier," Parsifal said with a gracious smile as he extended his arm. "There are fountains where you may refresh yourself, and bowers where gear such as yours can be changed for the dress of the revel. You may call me Parsifal, if I may call you." "It is Deirdre, my lord, Parsifal rather," the young cavalier said. Then she waved toward her associates and smiled at them. "I shall see you at mid-forenoon, then, and good night." Gord was the last to head for the rooms where they would rest, and he stumped along with a black look as he went. Surely, he thought, as bad as elven fickleness was, that of humans was worse still. Break. All right, this is the end of chapter 11, page 129. Again, we have that Parsifal doesn't really understand the full extent of what's going on. He seems, you know, fairly dense, so I'd expect his intelligence to be pretty low. A little while back, he referred to the magicians as magic users, and I'm not sure if that might be the first time that, you know, the class title was used as a description, you know, of a mage, or because they've called them just about everything in the book, mage, sorcerer, all, you know, so it's interesting. Now, we get a little plan of him discussing what the potential path is of Omni and his bandits. So, you know, we hear about Verbabank, they are no great distance from Hamlet, but at the same time, he thinks they're near Verbabank. It's actually a little bit of a distance between the city and the town, and as the town is on the southern border of Verbabank. But Verbabank is not a big area. I mean, it is basically the town with, you know, I'd say farmland and such surrounding it. And then the Velverdiva, which is the Verbabank city, is right on the Velverdiva. And that splits it. That's its northern border. And the Gnarly Forest is to the east. You know, it covers the separation there between the Gnarly and the Verbabank and the Wild Coast. So we're also getting, there's obviously some connection and also a delineation between Selene and the Elves of the Whelkwood, because it's mentioned by Anselvin that you are going to get help not only from Selene, but the Elves of the Whelkwood as well. So finally, we see, you know, a little bit with Gord still being a little angry and attracted to Deirdre, and Deirdre showing her own independence there and going off, obviously interested in Parsifal, and going off with him to join the festivities.
Gord is very flighty. I
mean, Gord?
He went from Yolanda back to, from Deirdre to Yolanda back to Deirdre.
Yes, and he is very much young Romeo. Romeo starts out the story, the play, by being direly in love with this woman who is someone he became in love with after being direly in love with a previous woman. And then he falls in deep love with Juliet first sight. So, you know, that is pretty much Gord all the way through. Gord really has this love at first sight thing, and he... so far, you know, he's a little older, but he does not seem all that much wiser. And at one point, he even was pining a little for Evelay. So, you know, Gord is, you know, he is quite the character there.
That's his tragic flaw so far, I would think.
Yes, yes. And as far as a character, it's actually not the worst. It helps to round out his character, him being such an idiot, about, you know, especially over women. It's that business with him being able to use his sling stone and peck the guy in the head who's riding the green dragon and save them all is unfortunate, I think. That is a little Superman storytelling. You know, you have a problem when you have a series of books about a character that really can't be defeated. You know, it's why they gave crippling flaws to some of the comic book characters, because then it became, well, like, what can't he do? And, you know, how is there going to be any story if he can never be, you know, truly at risk? And so they, you know, it's a little hard. It's a little hard with Conan, you know, when you know he's going to survive and be victorious. And Robert Howard, he worked with some stories to show Conan's vulnerability to magic. And so even though, you know, and it just made the character a little bit rounder. And of course, you know, really good writing can write through even an unfortunately flat character. And Gord tends to be pretty much, you know, a flat character, you know, and as the story goes, it was nice earlier on in Saga of Old City where he wasn't, you know, he was certainly growing in strength, but Gygax really did show that he certainly wasn't perfect. You know, he would get captured, he'd get into fights where he was, you know, wounded. He'd get into fights where the adversary would, you know, break away from him, or, you know, so Gord in the first book wasn't becoming so strong, and I really did have a hard time with that business with the sling stone and rescuing them all at the last minute. I just, you know, I like it more when Gygax is trying to stick to the game rules, you know.
Well, that wasn't even necessary there. If we had just stuck to the mechanic where they were ahead of the dragon, they're faster than the dragon. The dragon never could have caught them, and he never would have had to done that thing with the slingshot.
Yeah, I mean, I think what would have been more interesting if at the last moment the dragon's, you know, still far behind, but tries to use a breath weapon, or whoever is riding it tries to cast a spell or something, that would have made sense. And the direct attack by the green dragon just... It according to what Gygax wrote, which you have to wonder why didn't he write them more neck and neck? I mean, it was just why did he break what he was saying? Why did he write it that way, where it would have been impossible for the Green Dragon to reach the chariot of Sustar, and instead just have closed them? I mean, it was choices, and it was a very odd. I know it was supposed to create an excitement that they might catch them, but what he said removed that tension, and the only way he could recreate it was to break what he said. And so, yeah, you know, and it was just kind of like an unnecessary little thing right there. I don't know if that was maybe in sections of the book where Gygax was a little rushed, because if you consider the time period, and even what he mentioned at the end of Saga of Old City, he was trying to get out these stories with a huge burden of other work that he was doing. And I do not think, because he was who he was, that he actually got decent editing. You know, I assume nobody wanted to say, hey, you slipped up here, or this doesn't work, and I think he had an editor who was just maybe looking for grammatical problems, spelling mistakes, syntax problems, and just generally ignored anything to do with the structure of the story or the plot or the dialogue, and he just let everything go. And probably exactly what Gygax wanted, you know, he would not have wanted an editor who would have been taking out the red pen and marking up his manuscript with it.
Yeah, you should have sent it to us.
I know. I just imagine if I had been an adult back then. Well, I was an adult when this stuff came out, but I was, you know, I was pretty young in 85, I think it was 20. And I was 20. And, you know, it just, I think of all the things that could have been done back then and all the work that could have been done on it. It would have been much harder to put it out the way I like, just put it out so it could be enjoyed. I think I would have had to start one of those, fanzines like Alarums and Excursions to really get done what I'd like to have get done done back there. And Guy Gax really didn't like that kind of thing. You know, he really did not want people publishing, even in an amateur way, their own ideas and viewpoints. And if you sent them in to TSR, that was like sending them into a big garbage can, because that you could send in mounds of stuff, and I think a lot of it would never even been read. It was pre, even when they started Dungeon Magazine, very little
of their submissions ever made it to print, and once you sent it in, that's it. You know, they can grab hold of it and never really do anything with it again. So, in a sense, until the internet really came up, and until we started with Greytalk, I don't think there really was a good place. Now, I know a lot of guys did work on the AOL forums, and including like Eric Mona. They did a lot there, but it was a lot easier to do once Gary, here had started up the Greytalk forums.
All right. I am going to restart, and it is, it is chapter 12, page 131. So we're starting with chapter 12 and the first paragraph. You must leave now, said the cleric to the elf. Time works against you. Melf shook his head. I have but three others with me, he encountered. If there is to be a chance of overcoming more than a score of the most savage brigands in a decade, the party must be augmented. A good cleric, at least. I can offer no assistance there, came the reply, for this temple houses only myself and a handful of underpriests. None are suitable for such an undertaking, Melf. May I suggest to you that you underestimate your own prowess? Venerable Halamew, you subtly seek to influence me by flattery. I seek only to complete my mission. The balding high priest of Celestian smiled benignly, took the elf by his mail-clad arm, and steered him toward the rear exit of the chamber. Let us walk to the stables as we converse, he said. Although you serve Mordenkainen, Valuna's interests are at stake here also, I assure you. All that I can do has been done, and it is now up to you and your associates. But you are not alone. Honor and glory to the first who stopped these rogues and gained the prize. Are you certain that this intelligence is correct, Melf asked, tapping the small roll of parchment the high priest had given him earlier. The facts are as given, and divination has revealed that if you speed due east, the foe you will be met. The high priest reassured him. The elven warrior maid shrugged. Then we four bear a heavy burden, but bear it we must. Leave immediately, for all is in readiness. The stars guide you, and the heavens watch over you, Venerable Halamu said in benediction. Then smiling and clasping the gray elf's hand, he said, Melf, good luck. Before you go, there is a question I must ask. Melf was puzzled, but he liked the old cleric and nodded to him. You may ask, why do you use this name Melf, Prince Brightflame?
"Cease," Melf commanded, without regard for Halamu's station. "It is recorded that I gave up all titles and claims, so name not those bygone things to me. As for Melf, it is a simple name, as good as any." Then he unbent a little and admitted, "This art of demon crafting is a perilous one, good cleric, and one must protect one's true name as carefully as a miser hoards his treasured gold." "My blessings upon you and the others, then, Melf," said the priest, and he took his leave of the elven fighter mage as they reached the stables. Break. All right, so here's a little more about Melf. Luke Gygax's character. I wonder if how familiar he is with his father's writings here, and I assume that he is, and it is very interesting having his Melf character be part of this story, and an important part right here. Now, we get that this Halamu is a high priest of Celestion, obviously not an elf himself, as he's balding. The sense of importance and desperation has been is unknown to most of these people they're running into. It's surprising that Yolanda isn't more concerned, because she's supposed to be very isolationist as Celine is, and she is supposed to be very much concerned with the world at large and how it will affect Celine. And I can't think of anything more dangerous than this artifact of Tharaston's that could free Tharaston. And then here again, we have this high priest of Celestian, who really, if he knew what he was doing, would immediately gather all his strength, his underlings, and anybody could gather to go with them and help out. And here we have Chris posting Melf Prince Brightflame's write-up. So Melf, as a gray elf, is certainly, I think, part of the royal family, and probably in line of succession for the throne of Selene.
He said he was related to Anselvin, I think, right?
I'm not sure. Maybe. I didn't note that. 5'8", 200 years old, appears to be in his 20s. Yeah, he's cousin to Yolanda. And something that wasn't mentioned were the Knights of Luna. That is part of the, I believe part of the, it's from the Ashes.
Mm-hmm.
So that is more, maybe some more stuff that Sergeant came up with right there, rather than direct material from what Gygax had been writing.
I was digging. I saw some entries in Dragon Magazine, but they didn't have stat blocks.
Yeah. Yeah, there's, you know, there really is very, very little. And he is, of course, a great enough mage to have his own named spell. So he also was doing spell research. It's funny that if you look, oh, there it is, Melf's Acid Arrow. So he is part of the royals. He's a prince, or was.
It would be a good question to ask if he comes back on Jay's show,
definitely.
How familiar he was with his write-up in the books.
Yes, that would be, and that'd be a great question. And hopefully he will be on one of Jay's shows again. And I think I don't know if he's going to be available for questions, but... Jay is running that virtual Greyhawk Con, and I believe Luke Gygax will be in attendance.
If he's on the Ask the Experts at the end, he might be, and well, I just have to remember.
Yeah. Well, that is something. Last time he was on, I was thinking about. I unfortunately have not been able to do much. I'm good for maybe a half hour or so of Jay's show, and then. Unfortunately, I've been conking out very early.
It was a pretty good one last night.
Oh, yeah. I was sorry to. I caught like the first 45 minutes and that was all I, all she wrote. And then I was off. But yeah, it, you know, I've seen Ed Greenwood before on Jay's show, and it's so nice that all of this is archived. You know, this is, I don't think people realize how much stuff just gets lost, and to have this stuff archived visually and word for word, that is tremendous. That is truly tremendous.
And right now, all we lose is the chats, I think.
Yeah, you know, I mean, a lot of the stuff that we see in the normal chat, that's why I'm always trying to get my stuff up on Cannon Fire, because there you're really putting it into an archive, and the archive can be indexed and fold width tool where it's much more, and a better search engine put on. So we're very, you know, it's a shame that a lot of people who are participating in the Cannon Fire chats and the Cannon Fire, even the text, aren't thinking to make it a little more permanent by putting it on, you know, putting their write-ups and stuff right away on the Cannon Fire website, where it's going to be there and going to be referable. And, you know, so I love doing that. And of course, right here with everything we're recording is going right up on the Cannon Fire archives for this, and with plenty more that we can do with it.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 132, and it is the third paragraph from the end, right after this little break that was there in the middle of the page. Four armored riders cantered eastward on swift destriers. In the lead was the gray elf fighter and spellcaster Melf. Next to him rode his friend and henchman Biff. This halfling certainly had another name also, but as a swordsman and thief, one of his sort wished to avoid notoriety, to say the least. Behind these small figures came a pair of large men. The larger by far was Chert, a barbarian axeman wearing chainmail shirt and plain helmet. Leather leggings and heavy boots protected his legs, but he disdained a shield. Beside him rode a hard-eyed crossbowman who called himself Lizard. This worthy was clad in scale mail, which did lend a semblance of reptilian nature to him. Tall and lean-muscled, Lizard prided himself in his accuracy and his chosen weapon, the arbalest. So, break. So here we have Chert. I mean, we, you know, more with Melf, and we have Lizard and Biff. But it's good to see Chert returning to the adventure here. And obviously, I think this is, you know, all this has been, yeah. There's the picture of Chert that's been posted on the Fiction Text channel. And it's from Saga of Old City. It's the old Clyde Caldwell. I always expect Chert to have a beard. And he's got a little big, you know, head of hair, curly head of hair going there. All right.
And Brule, isn't that his axe name?
Brule is, yes. Now, you notice he's using a shield there.
Ah, yeah.
I think Caldwell has that wrong. I don't remember him. I don't know. I
think you're right.
Either at the Battle of Woodsford or later, with the Cat of Blind Demon, I think he just has that axe that he uses two-handed. Now, it'd be interesting if Caldwell had drawn the axe from the verbal description, but I'm not sure. You know, it's got its wide cutting blade and a spike on the back for armor piercing, you know, like a little can opener there.
A spike on the tip, too.
Yeah, it works both as a thrusting weapon, a chopping weapon, and also the back narrow the point of impact so it can more easily pierce armor. I don't know. It's a little, you know, it's a fantasy representation of an axe. You know, there's some problems with how it's depicted. Like the spear point should be going beyond the crescent of the blade, you know, because if you were going to jab, you'd really want the spear point to be able to jab in and there. It would kind of catch with the upper arc of the axe head side, the curved axe head. So, you know, it's armor and weapon. Caldwell was drawing it, but he really, I don't think he really understood weapons or armor itself. So, you know, it's definitely a fantasy version of weapon and chest plate of armor or leather armor with discs of metal probably sewn on the front. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 132 and the second paragraph from the bottom. "There is a fire under the elf's saddle," Lizard commented, as he and Chirp moved their steeds from canter to gallop, following Melf's lead. "Aye," agreed Chirp, laughing. "When I signed on for this expedition, I thought to escape the dull routine of soldiering in Valuna. Now we might as well be warding some caravan." "Better the merchant trained than this," the leathery-skinned crossbowman called back. "Caravans move at a more dignified pace, offer comfortable ease at night, and often have comely lasses amidst their baggage." Further conversation was withheld, for they needed their attention and wind for the journey. "There is the Velverdiva," Melf shouted as he reined in his sweating steed. They had ridden hard for 2 days to arrive at this place on the great river that formed the boundary between Valuna and the kingdom of Furiundi. There was a collection of buildings near the pier that marked the ferry here. "We will spend the night at Shan's Cross and take the first ferry tomorrow," said the leader. Break. All right. Now, this Shan's Cross is interesting. So it's a ferry across the Velverdiva, rather than saying it was some kind of fort or anything, because the Velverdiva is supposed to have most of the barge traffic and trade traffic that comes down all the way from Ket or into the near Dev, or from the near Dev to Ket. I'm not sure which way they have the river flowing. Now, so we can assume that it sounds like that high priest of Celestian, Halamu, must have been in Valuna, and they're heading. It sounds like they're heading to Furiundi, unless I've got it backwards here, but I thought that's what it might be.
So, I can't find that city.
Shan's Cross. Yes, it may be, or it may be changed. I noticed that Sargon changed the names a lot. Remember in Saga of Old City?
Right.
He would take one of the names. Yeah, and So the thing would be to look for something that matches the description, but maybe has a different name. And, you know, that's something we could do at a later time. We're getting pretty close here. It's 6:53. But I am very interested in hearing about these various cities. And we know that this one is definitely a ferry crossing. So that means quite a bit right there. And then the other thing that we're learning right here is something about the characters of Lizard, but also that Chirp was soldiering in Valuna after having left at some point after he left Gord in the city of Greyhawk. All right, I'm going to restart. It is the page 133 and the third paragraph. "There is the Velverdiva," Melf shouted as he reined in his sweating steed. They had ridden hard for 2 days to arrive at this place. Oh, I'm sorry. I've already read this. All right, I'm sorry. Fourth paragraph. "All were pleased to find a small but well-kept inn in the thorpe. Lizard, Biff, and Chirp retired immediately after supping, but Melf stayed late in the common room, sipping wine and listening to the crackle of the fire and the idle chatter of barmen and a pair of local patrons. Bring me a cold meat pie, Ocalard cheese of the smoke sort, fruit, and your best wine," a whining voice demanded.
This woke Melf from his doze, and he turned to see what the commotion was about. He noted that the order had come from a tall, skinny elf. As he looked, the lanky fellow returned his gaze with a smiling face but cold, cold eyes. Barman hurried to comply, going into the kitchen to fetch the viands, while a young wench, probably his daughter, drew a beaker of wine from a large cask behind the counter. The girl was well-formed. The mop of auburn ringlets that framed her delicate face was most fetching. "Draw two goblets extra, my pretty," the thin elf called to her as she finished filling the container he had ordered. "One for me, one for you," he said with a rising cackle. "Then you can help me carry the lot upstairs," he concluded with a suggestive giggle. The wench flushed and shook her curls. "My father does not permit me to drink with patrons," she said with a tone of disgust that could be taken as discontent with either the forbiddance or the offer. The expression on her pretty face, however, left little doubt as to the cause of her revulsion. "Hey, we'll see about that, my saucy little trollop. Armin, come here at once." Although the fellow was still laughing as he called, there was cruelty and threat in the cackling. Elf arose from his chair and strode to a place near the unsavory elf. "Allow me to buy those two flagons you mentioned, Sir Elf, and to introduce myself to a fellow demi-human. I am Melf of the Arrow, and you, sir." The skinny elf stared unblinkingly at Melf, assessing him carefully. It was evident that he cared for neither the intrusion nor the offer of wine, but Melf's steel-clad form and the easy bearing he maintained under the scrutiny disconcerted the other elf. He cackled to break the tension he felt within. "Yes, of course," he said. "I am Keek, and I will accept offer of a drink." "Keek, then, a native of these parts?" "Nay, a stranger like yourself, merely passing through," the odd elf giggled in reply. "Crossing the Velverdiva?" "No, my comrade and I are taking goods from his home in the Kron Hills to my own. Do you know High Folk?" Keek's laughter rang with a happy yet mocking note as he asked Melf the question. "It's a lovely, lovely place, you know." Elf could not help concluding that this elf was imbalanced. From a half-wit, such constant giggling and laughing could be expected, but Keek was certainly in possession of all normal faculties, except that they were awry. "I have been there once or twice, both town and valley," Melf responded. "Is your companion elvish, too?" "Ha, ha, he. That squatty little fellow elvish? Never. Some call us an odd pair, traveling alone together as we always do. My friend is most interested in rocks and soils, while I collect butterflies and other insects. But it works out well enough," said Keek, with a rollicking giggle and a wild eye. Break. And here we have a map of the area with no Shan's Cross. Here's the inn where Melf, leaning there, and Keek with a decidedly nasty expression on his face is there at the tavern there. So we have pictures here of Keek and Melf. It is interesting. This is quite the accidental meeting here. Not to the liking, definitely, of Keek or later Obmi. Now, this little bit of cringeworthiness isn't too bad, it doesn't get into anything more than Keek being a rather disturbing fellow, but it's part of where the story is going and to showcase like the vileness of Keek.
Now, I think it's great we get a picture of him.
Yes. Oh, I love the fact that we actually get... It would be nice if all the major characters had pictures and we had maps. There could be so much that could have been added to this book. Now, I wonder if we go all the way back, it's a tiny little thing, but I wonder what Ocalar cheese is. Whether it is a cheese that is a our world's cheese or something. Again, Gygax liked adding these little bits and pieces to the setting, like Furiani apple wine that was mentioned back, and a kind of, there were several cheeses mentioned back in Stoink that they got then. And so this is, I got to look up Ocalar cheese. And then from Saga of the Old City, we have I believe it was the Fruste, they had a cheese, and there was some kind of cheese, I think it was a cheese that came from the Back Looney. So there were all these various little tidbits that were added to just add a little bit of enrichment to the setting with its own uniqueness right here.
I don't think it's real world. I don't think it's Flannis. But it is 7, and I have to go.
All right. Well, good night, and thank you. Night. Thank you very much. This amazing stuff here. And so I'm going to end for the night. I'm going to call up the Craig bot, and this will be the end of recording number 14. And we're ending on page 132. Oh, where am I saying 132? No, I'm sorry. We're ending on page 134, and 135 was the illustration. So I'm going to call up Craig and kick him out of here.